What's up, everybody? How's everybody doing tonight? Good. It's good to be back. Good to see you. Hey, my name is Graham Shelby, if we have not met. And if this is your first time, we're glad that you are here. Quick question. Did anybody go to the movies in 2020? Like, I'm talking movie theater. Okay, we have a few. Yes, we went to the movies in 2020. I'm pretty positive there was like one movie that got released in 2020. Maybe I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure there was like one movie that got released. It was called Tenet. Did anybody see Tenet? Anybody seen that movie? Man, okay, so I saw that movie. It's a Christopher Nolan film. If you didn't see Tenet, you've probably heard of a Christopher Nolan film. He's produced some pretty great stuff. Think The Dark Knight, think Inception, think, what else? Memento, The Prestige, Interstellar. You got a lot of really big-time films. And I went and saw Tenet in 2020. It was about this time last year. And I remember walking out of the theater being like, I think I understood 12% of that movie. Like, goodness, that movie was so trippy. I think it was about, like, reverse time travel, something like that. Maybe, I'm not sure. But I didn't really get much beyond that. And not too long ago, I watched it again. And I picked up so much more. It's not actually about reverse time travel. It's about preventing World War III and all these things. And I learned so many more key facts, but also the deeper meanings that this film has to offer. And the reason why I tell you that is because in this new series that we're starting for the next 3 weeks called True Story, crazy stories about Jesus then that happened in thousands of years ago, but that can change your life now. We're going to look at stories that probably you would be able to say the headline summary of like, oh yeah, that story, it's like, this is what happened at first glance, but but oftentimes we neglect or overlook the deep, deep meaning that is intended for us. And it's not just meant to be a headline story, but it's meant to be something that if we see and if we mine for the gold that is there, it can quite possibly change your life. And that's what I'm hoping. That's what I'm praying for tonight. And so we're going to be looking at a story from the Gospels, which is the narrative, the stories about Jesus Christ when he was on earth in the book of John. And we're going to be talking about the wedding at Cana. And Jesus did a miracle. He did something crazy. At this wedding, he turned something into something. Does anybody know? Water into wine. There's your headline. Everyone knows that. Jesus, oh yeah, amazing party trick. Water to wine. Isn't that impressive? Wow, he did so many miracles. Maybe not my favorite. I think it's good, not the greatest. You know, he raised some people from the dead, healed a guy with leprosy. That's awesome. So, I mean, it probably doesn't rank highest, but it's a good miracle. And if that's all we see is a story about someone doing a party trick and making a drink alcoholic, that's not, we're missing it. Were me watching Tenet for the first time, thinking that it's about reverse time travel. And there's so much there. And so we're going to walk through this, and you're going to see three things. Jesus does miracles for a reason. It's not to show off. It's to show you who he is. The end goal is not the entertainment or the miracle itself, but it shows you who he is and what he's here to do. And this miracle shows you who Jesus really is and shows you what he's come to do, why he came to earth. It was his first miracle. Think debut, right? Like, you're talking about like your debutante ball, like what you're showing yourself to the world. Here, I'm presenting myself, and he chooses to turn water to wine. If you were God, is that how you'd start your ministry? It's how he started his. Why did he do it? We're going to see three things of the characteristics of Jesus. Why he did it. And then we're going to have three really simple applications of how we respond to it. Here's the headline up front. It's not about water to wine. This is the headline of the story right here. Why did Jesus come? It wasn't to change water to wine. Jesus came to give abundant joy to the world. It's a very simple, very churchy statement, but I'm going to unpack it. Those three things are how he did it. How does he give abundant joy to you and me? How does he do that? And then the three ways in which we experience it. That's where we're going tonight. So I'm going to read the entire story. If you don't have a Bible, it's going to be on the screen. John 2 is where we're going to be. It's 12 verses, pretty simple story. And we're going to go through it twice. Okay? We're going to go through it twice. I'm going to read it, pray, then we'll get going. Let me read it. John 2, it says this: on the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples, so it wasn't wedding crashing here. And when the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now there were 6 stone jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, each one holding 20 or 30 gallons. And Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." And they filled them up to the brim. And he said, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of a feast." So they took it. And when the master of the feast tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and then when the people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." This is the first of his signs that Jesus did in Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. And after this, he went down to Capernaum with his mom, his brothers, his disciples, and they stayed there for a few days. Let me pray. God, we invite you into this time. Would you open our eyes to see not just a headline story about water to wine, but really to see Jesus Christ for who he is and what he has come to do and how we might experience that. I cannot do that apart from you. And so I ask that you would open the eyes of everyone's heart and that we would see wondrous things from your word. Pray that in your name. Amen. Has anybody been to a wedding before where there's been an epic fail? Like, has anybody seen a wedding kind of gone wrong, either in part or in full? Would it surprise you? Would you believe it? True story, if I filmed one of the greatest fails of a wedding of all time? Check this out. Man, okay, so true story, I did not film that. That's not my video. But isn't that crazy? Dang, that actually happened. That is like the fail of fails in weddings. I Googled literally wedding fails. And now we can take that down. There we go. That is crazy. And the reason why I show you that is because that is literally the context of this story. You don't see it, you don't feel it, because you're like, oh yeah, the wine ran out. But this is what was happening in that day and age. Weddings back then were a bigger deal than they are today. It was a week-long celebration, not just your Saturday night. It wasn't just a 4-hour event. It was a 4-to-7-day event. And the groom's family hosted the whole town. And if you ran out of what you're providing your guests, you literally could be sued for it. Not kidding. So it was worse than you decking the bride off the deck into the pool because you tripped and lost the ring with it. This was humiliation. This was shame. This was reputation down the tubes for the rest of your days. And so this is chaos in progress. Wedding fail in progress that's happening in this moment. And Mary comes to Jesus and she asks him. And she says, "Hey, Jesus, they have no..." Or she didn't ask him. She says, "Jesus, they have no wine." And he says to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me?" Now, let's just be honest. That's weird. Who says that to their mom? I mean, like, put yourself in your shoes, or maybe just dial back the clock a little bit in life. And if you're, you know, in your house and your mom's like, "Hey, son, would you mind helping with the dishes?" And you're like, "Woman, what does that have to do with me?" You know, like, I'm going to guess that you're going to get slapped in the face, or at least I would by my mom, right? Like, it just wouldn't go well if I tried that tactic, regardless of if I did or didn't want to clean the room or do the dishes. Me saying that is not going to go great. But we also know that Jesus was perfect, sinless. He didn't say anything disrespectful. And so, like, what was he saying? Like, what does that actually mean? And why did he say it? I mean, think about it. Put yourself in the story. You know what happens. We just read at the ending of the story. He does the miracle. So if he's already going to do it, then why would you tell your mom? Why would you, like, dialogue with your mom this way, right? If you're already going to make water turn into wine, then why wouldn't you just tell your mom, "As you wish," because clearly he does it as she wishes. Why did he do that? What does his words mean? I think the clue is in the last part where he says, "My hour has not yet come." If you read the book of John, you will see over 15 times for the rest of the book that it is constantly repeated and repeated and repeated, talking about Jesus' hour, Jesus' hour, Jesus' hour. It had come, hadn't come, hadn't come, hadn't come, has come. And it's always referring to one thing and one thing only. And it's Jesus' death. That his hour, his time, is ultimately when he goes to the cross. And Jesus is saying to his mom's saying, can you help with the wine? And Jesus is saying, it's not time for me to die, which also still doesn't make any sense, right? Like, who talks that way? But here's what Jesus is telling his mom. He's telling his mom, hey, mother, we have different authorities and different agendas. Your agenda right now is an urgent social request, and your authority is the pressure of the social moment. I function differently. Yes, you're my biological mom, but my authority is God the Father, and my agenda is his will, which is my first point. How does Jesus provide and bring abundant joy to you and I? You might not expect it. It's by him submitting to God's will, first and foremost. Jesus Christ, time and time again, would say, hey, I can do nothing apart from God. I only listen. I only do what God says. Literally, that's what Jesus said. He's the most faithful person that there ever was, full of faith in God. He said, I do nothing apart from God, which, quite honestly, is really good news. Here's why this is good news. Let me help you think through this. Why would it be good news that Jesus submits to God's will? This is what it means. It means that Jesus is not swayed by cultural opinions. It's not that he's not someone who just gives you what you want. You're in college. You know this. Look back at your friends and their parents. The parents that were quote-unquote cool when you were growing up were probably the parents that would do whatever their kids said. And you're like, dude, those parents are sweet. Let them stay up whenever they want. No rules. It's awesome. You know who those kids turned out to be? Brats. One. Two. Crazy. Because they had no structure and no authority. The authority in their life just catered to whatever they want. And you can look back and dial the clock back and think through this. Is what I wanted then, hindsight 2020, was that a good thing at XYZ season of life? You can look back and be like, oh, that was not a good thing that I wanted then. I shouldn't have wanted that. Or, that didn't turn out well. I'm glad someone got in the way of that pending train wreck in my life. And when you have parents or authorities that are like, you just do whatever you want, sounds loving, it's not. And if you have a God who's just like, hey, I'm just a vending machine that whatever you want this, you need this, you need an A on this test, you want to do this, okay, you want this, it's like, that's not how God operates. That's not how Jesus operates. And he says, my agenda is bigger and broader than your immediate moment. It doesn't mean that your request is insignificant or that I'm angry at you by any means. We'll get to that later. But it just means that I think in a different way than you. I'm different than you. And that's probably, my guess, why he calls her woman. It's not because he's disrespecting his mom, but because in some ways he's acknowledging his deity and he's leveling her with all of humanity, which is the second reason why this is good news, is because Jesus doesn't play favorites. His own biological mom didn't have the friends and family discount spiritually. She didn't have the bypass other people. She didn't have the VIP pass. He constantly, Jesus over and over in the scriptures was constantly having to deal with this. That people, when he was going places, they were like, man, your mom is awesome because she gave birth to you and raised you. And he says, you know who's awesome are actually the people that do God's will. When people are like, Jesus, your family's waiting outside, he's always like, time out. My family are the people that do the will of God, not biological brothers and sisters, because I don't function with advantage and disadvantage or preference and exclusion based on who you are. Why is that good news? Because maybe you come from a dysfunctional family. And maybe you come from a family that's got a lot of baggage. And you might think, man, because of my upbringing, I have a barrier to be accepted by God. And Jesus is saying his own mom doesn't have any advantages. And so the inverse is true, that you don't have any disadvantages. Everyone gets in and relates to Jesus the same way, by faith. Doesn't matter where you've come from. There's no VIP or ranking system with Jesus. It's all level. And that's good news, that God knows better, that Jesus knows better, and that he doesn't play favorites. Let's keep digging in. Now, there were six stone jars there for Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons, and he says to the servants, fill the jars of water. They fill them to the brim, and then he says, take it out and give it to the master of the feast, and so they took it. Think about this. You know the miracle. You know what happens. He could have done it any way, right? Like any possible way. He could have snapped his fingers. Everyone probably had a glass in their hand. He could have just been like, wine in their hands. You know, like he could have done that. He could have done it in a ton of different ways. Why did he do it that way? It's really good actually to read the scriptures and to say, why does this happen the way that it happens? Because there's probably an answer there. It's good studying. And there's a clue. Jesus looks and he sees something, these jars of purification. What the heck are those? Well, in that time, people would do these ritual cleansing. Think like Purell for the soul. Everyone knows Purell because of COVID, but think Purell for like your heart and your soul. That's what they were doing, is they would have these rituals where they would bathe themselves to remind themselves that I am unclean, I am different from God, I am broken, and I need something to wash myself to make me acceptable to God. And Jesus, in doing it, the way that he's doing it is communicating something to you and I in 2021. He's saying that there is no ritual cleaning that you can do to make yourself right with God, that Jesus himself, this is my second point, that Jesus brings abundant joy by making us clean. He's saying, I'm the one who's going to make you clean. Nothing else. Nothing else. And you might look and be like, okay, that's kind of a weird context. Back in the day, they do these like ritual cleanings. That's kind of weird. Like, what were they doing back then? And we do the same thing right now. Right now. Whether you're paying attention or not, you have a sense of brokenness. And I guarantee you, if you're being honest with yourself, you know it and you feel it. You felt it today probably of like, I'm not the person that I want to be. There's a disconnect. I feel not as I should be. Whether that's because you're living in sin, in other words, a lifestyle that's contrary to how God's defined it, or you feel just this need to be perfect or need to be better, and you do this ritual cleansing. We do this ritual cleansing in all kinds of ways. Maybe it's hiding in secrecy. It's like, hey, my summer sucked, and I did some things that I regret, and so I'm coming into this semester, and I'm not telling anyone about it. I'm hiding. I'm going to pretend like no one's ever going to find out. I'm taking it to the grave. That might be you. Or maybe you've instead said, I'm just going to try harder. I'm embarrassed of who I am or who I'm not, and so I'm just going to put pedal to the metal, full force ahead. I'm going for it, and it's driving you in a perfectionistic ambition. And it's because you're trying to cover and clean yourself. Or maybe it's because maybe you do this by literally taking a bath. I mean, it might be silly, but I know for me, at times where I've felt disgusting and like sinful, I literally feel the need to bathe. There's something psychological and spiritual there. Or maybe you're here and you're trying to ritually cleanse yourself by showing up to the nine. And you're saying, man, I need to like pay God back for what I've done, and so I need to go to church like a billion times in a row for him to like me. And Jesus, in this story, through the way in which he does this miracle, is communicating to you, he's not mad at you. He's not mad at you for doing all those things. He's just saying it doesn't work. It never will, and it never has. The very first sin that mankind committed, Adam and Eve, what did they do? They covered themselves with fig leaves. It didn't work then, and we're covering ourselves in fig leaves still. It's crazy to think that the industry of what I'm wearing exists because of sin. That's crazy. We're covering ourselves, and we do it with our lives. And God's saying, I love you. You don't have to. It doesn't work. It only works when you let me clean you, when you let me do that. Jesus is saying that. Man, I mean, that is good news, is it not? The gospel is not do better or try harder, but rather give up and surrender and come to Jesus, who's the only one that's going to take away your guilt and your shame forever, once and for all. It's John 2. And there's more. Let's keep digging. Here we go. Let's keep going. The story continues. When the master of the feast tasted the water now become wine, he had no idea where it came from, though the servants who drew the water knew, and the master of the feast called the bridegroom. He said, everyone serves the good wine first when the people have drunk freely, and then the poor wine, but you've kept the good wine until now. Now, the master of the feast is like your functional MC of a wedding, right? Think like DJ with a little more responsibility. So, K, carrying the dance floor, but also like guiding every step of the way. And what does he say? He says, man, this is amazing stuff. What do we learn about Jesus through that right there? Jesus came to bring abundant joy. How? By providing what is lacking. What is lacking? Life itself is lacking. When you find and define life on your own terms, what man provides, what the human bridegroom provided, it didn't last. It literally ran out in the story, and it wasn't good. It was average at best. It didn't satisfy. What did Jesus do? He provided more than enough and the best. This is John 10:10. Later in the book of John, Jesus says this. He says, the thief comes only to kill, steal, and destroy. But I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. Sin works this way. It advertises pleasure up front, and it gives you a taste of it, and it's real, and it's fun, and it lasts for a moment, and then it's gone. And then what's replaced? Guilt and shame and heartache and brokenness. But Jesus says, but Jesus provides what's lacking, both in quality and in quantity. It's not just a funny story. I mean, yes, think about it. What he did, he provided almost 2,500 glasses of wine immediately. That's a lot. And it's the best of the best, because the guy who is running the show is the guy who's tasting it. He's a sommelier, and he's like, this is 100 on the scale. This is amazing. And that's just a calling card for Jesus of saying, where you define life, it doesn't last. When you let me bring what's lacking, I bring more than enough, and I only bring the good stuff. Proverbs 4 says it this way. It says that the path of the righteous is like the light of dawn, which shines brighter and brighter until full day. Sunrise only gets brighter. And what that verse is saying is that with Jesus, it just keeps getting better and better. That's what it's saying. When you follow Jesus, it just gets better and better. Is that your experience? Is that your experience following God? I just want to ask you a few questions. When you think of a relationship with God, do you correlate it with joy? Like, do you think of a fullness? Is that your experience? Do you even think it's possible to follow God in college and for there to be an abundance of life? If you're asking the question, man, like, if you're acknowledging, like, man, I don't feel joy when I think of God, and I don't know if I can experience it, I want to tell you, I mean, that this is who God is, who Jesus is. He wants you to know that. But he also wants you to know how to experience that. Because it's good that he gives it, but how do you experience that? This same passage, we're going to walk right back through it fast. It's going to show you how you experience it. And it's through the interactions. There's some takeaways through the interactions that Jesus has in this story, another layer deep. That's going to show you how do you experience the joy that Jesus came to provide. Let's go backwards. The wine runs out. Mary comes to Jesus. What does she say? They have no wine. How does he respond? Woman, why do you involve me? It's not my time. What does she respond then with? Going to the servant and saying, do whatever he says. If you look at the bookends of those two responses and you look at Mary, I think one of the ways that I experience, that we experience, is my first point of application, that you experience the joy that Jesus brings, is by prayer. I think this is a good example of prayer, of how we pray. Mary comes to Jesus with a real request. And here's what the text doesn't say, is what was her motive for coming to him? Was it selfish? Was it selfless? It was clearly urgent and rushed, and she had we need wine here. It could have been for a whole multitude of reasons. She knew that there was a wine problem, which means that she was really intimately involved in the wedding. Usually you kind of don't go back in the kitchen unless you kind of are running it or having a big involvement. And so she might have felt, hey, I might be embarrassed, or there's something at stake for me. And so, hey, Jesus, this would be really helpful for you to not kind of ruin my day and my life. And we don't know her motives there, but she goes and she requests something to God. And then she leaves that dialogue with Jesus in confidence and submission of saying, whatever he says, right? And that's just a simple way of, hey, how do I communicate? What is prayer? Prayer is FaceTime with God. It is communication with God. It's not some ritual. It's not some thing that I have to do and say the right things, and then all of a sudden God will give me what I want. It's just me interacting with the person who made me and made the world. And one of the ways that Jesus teaches us how to communicate with God is say whatever you want. Bring your full self and what you need to God. But also acknowledge who you're talking to and surrender what you bring. Submit your requests and surrender to his authority. That's what Mary does. She says, this is my request, FYI, fix it, please. You know? And then I submit. And that might look like you saying, God, I really would love a significant other tomorrow. And I've prayed that the last 75 days straight. And that's good. It's not bad. God's not offended by that request. Or like, God, I really would love to like not fail this year in biology. It's tough, you know? Like that's okay. That's a great request. Or God, I really would love for people to like me. I'd love friends. Or God, I'd really love to like, you know, make a difference in the job that I work. I'd love a job. I really would love a job. You know, an internship would be great, God. Those are fine requests. But then you give that and you submit that and you say, I trust you with it. I'm going to let you do on your timetable what you will. And I trust that you don't make mistakes. You have my best interest in mind, and I believe you're good. Philippians 4 is a great, example or just teaching of that. Of don't be anxious about anything, but in everything with prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your request to God. Let him know. 1 Peter 5:7 says that we should cast our anxieties upon God because he cares for us. That means that you can tell him why you're upset and what you want and what you didn't love about the day. But just don't let that be the only thing you do. Like, align your heart with what God's doing and surrender to his will and his pace and what he's after. And that's prayer. And when you do that, you're going to experience joy. You're going to experience the joy that Jesus practically came to bring you. You're going to experience that today, right now. It's possible. What's another way that we can do that? Let's look at the other interaction that he has. There are six stone water jars. We heard that, right? And Jesus says to the servants, go and fill that up with water. So they fill all of that up. And then he says, take a glass from that and go give it to the master of the feast. Just, can you imagine? Can you imagine these people that don't know Jesus? They're like, we have a wine problem, bro. And you're telling us to fill up that many gallons of water? Like, are you outside of your mind? You have to imagine that they're like filling up the water being like, I have no idea what the heck he's telling me to do. I have no idea why he's telling me to do this. And then he's like, hey, now here's a social risk. Dip the water and go give it to that guy to take a sip. And you got to be like, big risk, okay, all right. But what does it say? Twice. They did it. They did what Jesus said. How are we going to experience the abundant joy that Christ wants to bring us? It's by obedience. It's by saying, whatever you say, God, I'm going to do it. If you tell me to do something, I'm going to do it. I've had to learn this over and over and over and over again, that God's commands are for our good. They're not things to restrict you from life. They're actually pathways to experiencing it. When God says, thou shall, right? The King James of you should do this. Thou shall. Instead of hearing slap on the wrist, you can't do that. What you should hear is, because I love you, I want you to know. Thou shall means because I love you, I want you to know. Not you can't do that. 1 John 5 says that this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not burdensome. These guys were not given the full picture. They weren't given details about Jesus. He wasn't like, hey, play-by-play, this is what's going to happen, They weren't given the full detail, and here's the deal. You aren't either, and I'm not either. His commands might not make sense, but he's going to give clear ones. And he also might guide you in a way that might not make sense in the moment, but he's guiding you for your good. Over and over and over in the Bible, we get pictures of this, that God calls people to things that they don't understand. And I just got to say, you should expect that in your life. That he's going to call you to things this year that you might not have the full grasp on. And that's okay. That's okay. The way to experience the fullness of joy that Jesus comes to provide is by saying, all right, from what you tell me to do, I'm going to do it. And I'm going to trust every step of the way. And that's what these servants do. And they get to experience. They're the firsthand witnesses. Because the master of the feast has no clue. But what does it say? The servants knew. Here's my guess. My guess is they fill up with water because it says that. And my guess is that in between when they fill it up and when they dip the water into wine, it becomes wine. My guess, just my guess, is that I think God rewarded their obedience. And when they put that cup in, what they drew from was water. What they drew out was wine. And they got to see the first miracle. I don't think that they brought water to him and were like, gosh, he's about to drink water. This is going to be the ultimate troll and prank. I don't know what's going to happen. I think they knew. And they came and walked and they're like, oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. I think that's what he did. Who knows? We'll find out in heaven. But I think that God rewards faith. And the Bible says that without faith, it's impossible to please God. And so faithful obedience is what pleases God. That's what Hebrews 11 says. You need to know that. Well, one other way, the last interaction of how we will experience the joy that Jesus comes to bring is in this last moment. The master of the feast. He drinks that wine and he responds. And what does he say? He says, you know, hey, well, you're supposed to technically do this. You know, you're supposed to have the good wine last and the good bad wine first, whatever, all that stuff. He says the technicalities, but what is he really saying? He's saying, this stuff's amazing. Yes, dude, this is great. What practically is that? I think practically that's worship. It's you experiencing the goodness of God and you responding to that. That's what he did. He didn't know what he was responding to, but he literally responded to it. I have experienced the goodness of God. I am literally responding to it vocally. Now, when we think worship, what do you think? Do you think it's just three songs sung by him? Hillsong, Watermark Music? No, that's not just worship. Of course it's music. But worship is what we do with our lives. Where do I get that? Romans 12:1 says this, that therefore in view of God's mercy, because of seeing who God is, because of seeing Jesus as not just a talent guy who can change water to wine, but seeing him as the Son of God who gives abundant joy, in view of God's mercy, offer my body as a living sacrifice, which what? Is your act of worship. How do you experience, how do you worship in life? I mean, you worship through, you can worship through the job, your internship. You can worship through studying. You can worship through the way in which you date. You can worship through anything. It's seeing God, experiencing that, and responding to that. You can't worship what you don't experience. Are you experiencing God? Taste and see that the Lord is good, Psalm 34:8 says. And Jesus wants you to experience him. So in summary, Jesus came to bring abundant joy. How does he do that? By submitting to God's will. He does that by making us clean and by providing what's lacking. How do we experience that? How do we experience that? By prayer and by obedience and by worship. I just want to tell you, man, that Jesus loves you. They sound so cliche. But what he was doing was symbolic, okay? His hour hadn't come yet, and he ultimately was going to bring abundant joy. He brought a lot of joy in that moment. Don't you know it? I mean, wine for days. Everyone was like, yes, party, let's go. He kept the party going. But what he was looking forward to was saying, I'm ultimately going to bring the most abundant and lasting joy, and the way I'm going to do that is by giving up mine. That I am going to be stripped of my joy in my life, and I'm going to pay so that you could experience it. And it's not going to be wine that I give, it's going to be blood that I give. Symbolic. And I'm going to give, it's going to cost me everything. And you nothing. And he's going to go 100% of the way to the brim. He's going to purify. And he's going to give it all. And what do we do in response? What do you have to do in response? You just come to him. You acknowledge that you can't clean yourself. that you can't be the perfect, obedient son, and that you can't provide what's lacking in your life, but he can. Scripture literally says that to be made clean, you have to wash yourself in his blood. Sounds kind of weird, but when you think about it, what he's saying is the way in which you make yourself clean, you cover yourself, is with his sacrifice and not your works. And you can rest in that. When you do that, in a one-time decision and with your life, you experience the joy that he came to bring. Let me pray. God, thank you for your word. Thank you for the story that is so rich. Oh my gosh. God, forgive me for ways in which I have just seen this story as, oh, Jesus party trick, water to wine. Yeah, that's the headline. That's pretty good. Whatever. And missed all of the deep riches, the glory that you show and reveal. Show who you are. Man, pray for friends in the room tonight that don't feel like enough and are acutely aware of it, that they would not hide or continue to feel like they need to carry that. I pray they would give it to you, that they would see you, they'd trust in you, and they'd let you be the one that makes them clean. And I pray that those that have been made clean, that they'd live like it, that they wouldn't be a shame-filled Christian, which is an oxymoron, that they would be a joy-filled Christian, and they'd experience the abundance that you have paid for them to experience. I pray that in your name. Amen.